Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 127 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. We're at the tail end of back-to-back episodes featuring very talented mastering engineers. Last week's guest was one of the legends, Greg Calbee, who's been doing top-notch high-profile work for a half century. This week, we pass the baton to a younger engineer who's been wowing listeners with her own masterful mastering work, Cicely Ballston. I first became aware of Ballston through albums I bought via the Vinyl Me Please Record Club. She's worked in a variety of genres, mastering Bright Eyes' acoustic indie rock album, I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning, and a posthumous Chelino Sanchez Narco Corrido compilation, among others. But she has made her name at the record club with a series of hip-hop releases, including Eric B. and Rakim's Don't Sweat the Technique, Grave Digga's 6 Feet Deep, The Coop's Genocide and Juice, Busta Rhymes' The Coming, and Madlib's riff on old Blue Note recordings, Shades of Blue. Now, those of you who know me or have picked up on my musical tastes via Caro Pop might conclude that I'm not much of a hip-hop guy. You'd be correct, but I'm working on it. And when the albums pop out of the speakers like the ones Ballston has mastered, I get it. Others get it too. The announcement of her as the mastering engineer of a new VMP hip-hop release, such as the Wu-Tang Clan's The W, turns up the excitement knob on the VMP Discord, and the title often sells out. So I decided to find out, who is this Cicely Ballston, and how does she do what she does? For one, she's a young British woman who works at London's Air Studios, co-founded by the late Beatles producer George Martin. She's also the 2023 winner of the Music Producers Guild Mastering Engineer of the Year Award. She tells us what songs she submitted to be judged. She has remastered a bunch of David Bowie's back catalog, as well as albums by Jamiroquai, Self Esteem, Witch Fever, Alison Moyet, Simply Red, and many others. Does mastering a hip-hop album require its own specific skill set? Did she come into this as a hip-hop fan? What was her path to becoming a mastering engineer? What and how many instruments did she learn to play while growing up? How long does it take her to master an album? Does working in an all-analog process take longer than one involving digital? Is analog inherently superior to digital? What's the most commonly misunderstood aspect of what she does? She discusses this and a lot more, all with great spirit. I love getting to know her and hearing about her excellent work, and I know you will too. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Cicely Ballston.
Don't you know? I told everyone. I even told the rising sun that I really miss my friend.
How many days a week do you work?
So I do three long shifts, do 3 12-hours normally. Normally, I share my studio with someone else. Barry Grint. So you kind of a day on, day off type pattern.
Got it. Yeah, no, I'm a member of that Vinyl Me Please Club, and Barry Grint from Air Studios, or you from Air or Alchemy and then Air, but now it's just Air. So you guys work in the same studio together.
Yes, we share a studio, and there's two other mastering rooms at Air with three engineers across them.
How long does it take you to master a record? Like, do you do a few a week, a day?
To master or to cut, or to master and cut, or just everything, anything?
Yes, everything, the whole thing.
Everything, the whole thing. So for like digital mastering, might take me a day to do an album. But then, you know, if there's a bit of back and forth, a bit of tweaks, then normally that's kind of across a few days in total. Of work, but it might be across a few weeks in terms of communication. And then cutting the record, it's just sort of from the masters already done. You know, it's a few hours to check it, to make sure it's going to be okay, to do some test cuts, to make sure the lathe is all working properly. And then just the length of the album. So it's real time once you start cutting.
What's the difference in time between doing digital and an analog master? Well, first of all, I guess the extreme would be like that you're AAA, where it's all analog, and then there's you know, some where there's digital steps in it. Is there sort of a continuum, like on this end, this is sort of the fastest, and this is the most labor intensive?
There isn't really like a noticeable continuum, no. Just because each project, you apply the same thinking and the same processing. If something was coming off tape, needed mastering from tape and to tape, and then cutting from tape, that would probably be extremely labor intensive. I don't think I've ever done anything that's exclusively tape in my career. But otherwise, in terms of the thought that's going into it and the approach, then it doesn't. It's more project by project than actually what ends up being the specific workflow. If that makes any sense,
right? And at VMP, so, you've done a lot of these the hip hop records, and I was just listening to you. The 45 RPM Eric B and Rakim Don't Sweat the Technique. And I have to say that I'm not like generally a hip hop person. And I've sort of been using this club to kind of, you know, branch out and try to appreciate stuff that I didn't really get as much when it was coming out at the time. So you've been very helpful for that, because that record sounds great and it's fun. And I'm wondering if that was
It's a cool record.
It is. It's funny. It doesn't say 45 RPM anywhere on the record. And so the first time I put it on, I'm just like, wow, this is really some slow jams, you know? And then I was like, wait a minute, no, it's 45. I got to put it at the, which sounds better, for multiple reasons. But was the hip hop like a specialty of yours, or is that just sort of a niche you've carved out?
I think it's a niche I carved out. It's and it's not necessarily one that applies across all of my work. It's that kind of collaboration. I think I just did a few for Vinyl Weeklies. As you mentioned, both me and Barry work for VMP.
Right.
I think a few just came my way for whatever reason. And then I think they were liking how they sounded, or they got some good feedback on them, so started sending me some more. It's been a really cool process, because actually the same is true for me. It's not that I'm not into hip hop. I do like it, but it's not really a genre that I've ever listened in, like, my own personal listen to really in depth. It's not really I often think this as I'm cutting those records, particularly, like, it's not really I grew up in North London. I'm white, I'm pretty middle class by lots of standards in the UK. So like this kind of all this hip hop that's coming out of all these like areas across the US is like, it's been amazing really listening to it in depth and really kind of getting into it in a way that I hadn't before. And but yeah, for whatever reason, just the cuts that I was doing, Vinyl Please were liking. Yeah, I ended up doing a lot of them. It's been great.
You know, you also did Bright Eyes, you did Chilino Sanchez, which is a completely, you know, different kind of record. So you've done a few other ones besides the hip hop. Is there a different skill set needed for, you know, doing hip hop versus doing, you know, like a sort of rock folk record, or, you know, whatever else, David Bowie, which, you know, and other things you've done in, you know, other parts of your career?
Yeah. It's not a different skill set. I think the fundamental, like, underlying thing with all of these is the approach. So, you know, I listen to a hip hop record if I'm cutting the lacquers for that. There are things that are important, like the bass line, the kick drum, the kind of like things that will affect the mechanics of the vinyl, that are perhaps genre specific. And so I might know that if it's like a really long side and it's hip hop, then like prioritizing the kind of the low end, or prioritizing the clarity of the speech, you know, whatever it is more important perhaps than like, it just in some cases maybe than overall level on disc, because maybe it's not going to be played out in a club. It's someone's going to be listening to it and appreciating it, and they can set their own volume.
Right.
So like maintaining the character of the music is more important. Whereas like if there's a kind of, you know, like I've cut quite a lot of metal as well, and if you end up like, you know, you've got wide pan guitars, you've got you know, really heavy kind of like double kick drum, kind of double pedal stuff going on, you know, then it's important to preserve the character of that. And maybe other factors, you know, are less important or whatever it is. And so you sort of, it's not to do with like a different skill to cut different styles of music, but it requires a kind of, you got to think about what's important and what you want to come across as well as it possibly can. And the cut will vary a bit. There are sort of subjective choices I'm making in the cutting process towards bringing out the sort of the important parts of the music, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, with hip hop, certainly there's often an emphasis. People sort of listen for the beat, and you know, they like they'll comment a lot. If you read sort of comments, they'll always comment on sort of the bass, you know, the bass quality, or the bass is loud enough, and if the bass is thumping enough, or whatever. Whereas you're not going to get that on Bright Eyes. So it does seem like it's you know, they're sort of different expectations, obviously, for different albums or types of music.
Yeah, exactly. So you kind of got to, so yeah, it's not a totally different skill to cut the different ones. It's the skill is trying to understand what needs to come across, I guess.
So with Madlib Shades of Blue, which was his sort of remix of old Blue Note recordings, that came out last year on VMP. And then there was a Kevin Gray cut of it that came out on Blue Note like a few months later. Were you aware that there were going to be two versions of it? And do you go and like kind of get both of them and compare and say, well, see what I did versus what Kevin did?
I wasn't aware, and I might do that now. That's really cool. That's so interesting. Like, that's such a great insight into what differences there could be, right?
I think there's a whole story to be done about like licensing of records, because there's some of them that just haven't come out in ages. And then there's some where, you know, again, like John Prine had a bunch that came out, and then VMP did ones. You know, Mobile Fidelity did Harry Nilsson, and VMP's doing those. Yours came out. The VMP one came out, and then the Blue Note one was announced. And I think the VMP one was colored vinyl, and the Blue Note was black vinyl. But the Blue Note had a gatefold. I don't have the Blue Note one. I got yours. but then of course, then you get on these forums, and then people are comparing them. And Kevin Gray, sort of known for doing these kind of, you know, Blue Note recordings, and he's been on, you know, talk to me as well. There, I mean, I saw people comparing the two cuts, and people generally liked yours because they thought it just sounded more in keeping with what the music was sort of about, and like that you're having an ear for hip hop as opposed to coming in with an ear more for jazz, for instance. Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't done the A/B myself. I'm sure that they both sound wonderful, but
yeah, well, this is it, right? Because we would have been in two separate studios doing two separate cuts, and like we're both just doing what we think is best, or like what is going to suit the cut that we're trying to do the most. Like it really shows. Sometimes, you know, I wonder how much cutting. I kind of call it a craft. Like, I think to call it an art would be quite far. And like, the art has already happened. Like, the art is the music that's going on, you know, and the cutting is a craft. You can sculpt it, and you can be really good at it, and you can make subjective choices, but the content isn't, you know, fundamentally different. I'm not like adding music or taking that away. But that's super interesting that there were two cuts within a short space of time, and that people do compare and contrast like that. So yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Well, on the VMP subreddit page, they do every year at the beginning of the following year, they have like a sort of a survivor, like, you know, elimination, bunch of elimination rounds to determine what was the best album in each of the, you know, categories of the records of the month. So like the Eric B. and Rakim was not a record of the month, but Shades of Blue won the hip hop one. So that was like the top one. And some people were like, it's like, wow, I can't believe this, you know, this one won, even though there was another cut of it, and So that was, so congratulations. You know,
I've stopped my video. You can't see how much I'm smiling. That's so cool.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, you got the Music Producers Guild and the best hip hop of VMP for the year. So congratulations. I'm sure you could put the two trophies next to each other.
Yeah, that's amazing. Is there a trophy for them?
I don't know. A little Reddit trophy. You could just print out the page and tack it onto your bulletin board or something.
That's amazing.
Presumably, would you and, you know, Kevin Gray have gotten the same source material? Would they, you know, does that, whoever you're licensing it from, do they just say, okay, here's this, you know, high definition digital version of the album? Or is there sort of a negotiation like, oh, we want these sources and not these sources?
I don't get much. We have a discussion if there's anything that like comes up when I'm listening, or when I get the files, or whenever I get the source, like, then there's a discussion to be had, but I don't get much choice over it. And I assume that you get the same, because whoever owns the original music presumably has their kind of, I don't know, they know what they normally license out. But I actually listened to a bit of your interview, I can't remember their name, but with Vinyl Me Please.
Andrew Winnestorfer.
Yes. Yeah. And he was saying how much they go towards towards sourcing the audio and towards speaking to the labels and trying to find the best copy possible, and like the differences that they found across time with whether labels were happy to give them tapes or not. It was interesting. It was really interesting to hear.
Right. Yeah. Because you'll have two things again, like Honky Chateau, the Elton John album came out, and VMPs like ours is AAA, and the other one that's coming out in general stores is not. And I'm like, so
yeah.
It's interesting that you would have, again, the same album, the same anniversary, but one of them is sourced in one way and mastered in one way, and one of them sourced and mastered in another way.
Yeah, but presumably both are trying to do what they think is right. You know, the kind of AAA thing is important, but increasingly tapes are pretty old. They're pretty, they're not getting any newer. The glue isn't holding any better than it was before. So, like, maybe a transfer that was done really well, but, like, 10 years ago or something could easily be a different sound, but to some arguments better than the tape that is existing now, than retaking it off tape. Like, there's going to be a whole lot of discussion about that, I'm sure, coming up.
Yeah, do you think the all analog thing is kind of overrated, and that there's sort of the sense of, oh, if it's not AAA, you know, it's not worth it. Whereas, you know, there's some really great sounding records that have digital steps in them, obviously.
Yeah, I think it can be taken. I think it can be taken too far, and I think it can sometimes, in some discussions I've seen, I try not to spend too long dwelling in these kind of forums, but like it can be to the exclusion of what I would say is important, which is the music and the music being released, and like just getting really, really bogged down in the kind of in that detail, although attention to detail is important, and like doing things properly is important, and trying to do things as well as possible is important. But I wouldn't say that analog always equals better, personally.
I think that people associate analog with this quality they would call warmth. And sure. And especially because when CDs came out, the first ones were so kind of harsh sounding. And originally it was sort of exciting because it's like a tambourine sounded like it was just like clanging in your ear. But yeah. After a while, it sort of felt, you'd sort of go back to a record and you're like, oh, there's something a little warmer and smoother about this. Is there sort of a trick to, you know, making, you know, an album sound warm, whether it's digital or analog?
Interestingly, I think, you know, the word warm comes up a lot in discussions of, and when I say digital mastering, I mean digital output. I mean, mastering for streaming or CD or whatever. Like, I don't specifically mean using digital. I don't mean exclusively using digital processing in my chain. Just FYI, right. I use some analog equipment as well, even if the thing is going to WAV, even if the track is going to WAV or whatever. Anyway, sorry, so that's just a bit of like a pedantic.
No, that's useful. Actually, that's another question I'm going to ask you about.
Yeah.
The digital, you know, mastering for different formats and how, what you got to do for that. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
That's
warm,
what we're on.
Yeah, yes. The warm comes up a lot, and it actually means like quite different things to different people, I found, on a sort of technical level. If someone says warmth, it's very easy to assume they mean like bass, or they mean a sort of like smoothing of the top end or whatever. But then some other people have come to me and they mean what I would say is like clarity, or they mean like depth, or they mean, you know, and this is interesting what the kind of like subjective terms actually mean. I don't think that as a rule all analog sounds warmer than all digital, because I think there's just too many things going on in both of those categories to possibly draw any sort of anything like that. You know, you could cut a vinyl, and also the top end on vinyl is quite an interesting thing because it distorts really easily, so vinyl can easily can easily sound thin, can easily sound bright and distorted, which wouldn't necessarily be what people mean by warm. Right. And I wouldn't agree that it would sound nice, but it's a sort of it isn't as linear perhaps.
Did you follow this controversy about mobile fidelity, where there was an assumption that it was all analog, and then when they found out there were some digital steps, they were sued for, you know, misrepresenting what they were doing, and there was sort of an assumption that, oh, I'm not, you know, some people like, I'm not going to buy mobile fidelity now because there's a digital step in it.
Yeah.
And mobile fidelity is like, sounds really good. You know,
yeah. I haven't been following that in detail, but I have come across, and they did the thing that sounded good, and that was what everyone was trying to do. I think sometimes it's easy to fill in the blanks of what sometimes the little bits of the kind of forums that I have looked at or whatever. There's just lots of people speculating wildly about what they think people have said or that people have done or what the intentions were behind decisions or whatever, what decisions got made. And it's, you know, it's like with any form of communication, it's not necessarily true. You know, you can't tell what anyone else is saying or doing or thinking all the time.
Well, yeah, because you'll have, like, there will be some albums that will be, you know, AAA mastered from the original master tapes, which, of course, you know, the assumption or hope is that the original master tapes are in good shape because they could lose some of their, you know, dynamics after a while. And then there's some where they're like AAA mastered from tapes. So then the assumption is like, you know, well, it was a one-to-one transfer done really well at some point, but it's still a generation away. So from tapes is kind of, you know, The Vinyl Me Please Miles Davis box was from tapes, and people think that sounds fantastic. And then there's, you know, not AAA because there's a digital step in there, but maybe it sounds fantastic too. And there's still analog steps in there, but it doesn't have that sort of AAA imprint that a lot of the vinyl nerds, you know, look for, which maybe does not necessarily, again, as you said, correlate to how good it's going to sound because there are a lot of other factors involved.
Yeah. I just think, and there's so many assumptions that people make when, if there's AAA from master tape, you know, is that the vinyl production master tape, or is that the master tape that came out of was that the US territory vinyl production master tape? Was that the Northern Europe vinyl production master tape? Was that, you know, whatever? Like, there's so many things that you could be assuming about what any of that means. But you've got to, you know, I think quite reasonably people are into it. You know, it's not a bad thing to be engaged and to be involved and to want things to sound good. And so it's important to find the people, the labels, the reissue labels, whoever, you know, that are producing things that as an individual, as any individual consumer, like trusts and wants, you know, wants to buy from. That's
right.
That informs their choices. That's fine. But then, yeah, that's just, I think, a lot of time and a lot of words spent on just discussing things that may or may not be useful.
Right. The ears test is sort of the key one. And then there's half speed mastering too, which could be analog or not analog as well. Is half speed mastering like something inherently good or not good?
I don't think there's any sort of any inherent good or not good about any of this stuff. Half speed is another tool that we can use. It is good for some things, you know, it slows the whole process down. The high frequencies can get a bit more, like space, I guess, a bit more time to be cut in, so they could be perhaps reproduced more faithfully. But actually, like with any format, like with all vinyl, some things suit it and some things don't. You know, it's there's aspects of sounds that sound really good on vinyl. There's some tracks that sound really good on vinyl, and there's actually some things that don't suit it so well. And the same is true for half speed. Same is true for direct metal. The same is true for, you know, all of these things.
Right.
Have sounds. And I just don't think there are any hard and fast rules. Basically, half speed can be a really, really useful tool if you've got some tricky top end. If you've got a really long side, because you often end up with a louder cut because the lathe can sort of fit the grooves together a bit better. It can be really great, but that's not always true, and it's not always going to be the same amount of great, you know.
Do you do half speed at air?
Yes, yeah, we do.
And is that like put as a sticker on there, like half speed mastered at air? Because like the ones at Abbey Road, all those Who ones, it's like half speed master, you know, Abbey Road. Yeah. And it's all like at Abbey Road too, because I was like, it's like the Beatles.
Yeah.
You're George Martin's place, so, you know.
I think it's a good thing, because I think they did that around, you know, I want to say the first time around, whenever half speed was first, the 80s or 90s or something, there was a bit of a campaign, I think, around then, for Half Speed. I can't remember what it was called.
I first saw that on the early Mobile Fidelity recordings, like Dark Side of the Moon and Crime of the Century by Supertramp, and it would say Half Speed Master. But they don't do Half Speed Master now at Mobile Fidelity, but they do it at Abbey Road and some other places. And again, it's become sort of a brand thing for, you know, oh, well, I got the Half Speed Master of Quadrophenia, and it sounds amazing.
Yeah. And that's cool. Like, yeah, great. If it sounds amazing, then
that's what I've heard. I've not gotten the Half Speed
Master. No, I know, but yeah, as an example. Half Speed definitely can, but I don't think with anything audio, it's all subjective. It's all choices. And
So to go back to the putting it out for, you know, streaming, for CDs, which is, you know, less important than it used to be, for vinyl, do you have to sort of create multiple masters depending on whether it's going out on, you know, a high definition streaming service versus going on to a, you know, piece of vinyl?
For vinyl versus anything else, yes. There's the very pedantic technical level of, like, a vinyl master is the lacquer. It is the disc that has been cut. So we get a fair amount of, WAV _ vinyl master. It's not really... This is, again, I didn't mean to come across as quite such a pedant here.
No. I'm asking about this stuff. I'm interested, and I think people are interested in, like, the details. That's good.
Yeah. I think there's things you can do to a WAV to suit it to vinyl better. If you know how to cut and if you know how vinyl works. But equally, there's lots of things that maybe are flying around the internet. There's lots of, like, misinformation, and you sort of end up with lots of hard and fast rules, which generally don't work in audio because it's all subjective. So it would be a shame if everyone that was sending, you know, that I hadn't mastered the digital for, but I was doing the cutting, and if everyone who was ever sending me something to cut from, like, you know, high passed the audio at like 100 hertz or like... to put an elliptical filter in to mono the bass really high up when actually that wasn't a necessary step because the audio wasn't that long or there were other factors that could have been amended for the cut, and therefore you sort of lost some information which didn't need to be lost because someone has read somewhere that all vinyl must have mono bass or whatever. But I don't tend to do different masters for different streaming CD for different kind of digital delivery. And that's partly just because you can't predict all the different distributors. They have different requirements still. All the different streaming services have different, like, loudness. They change their loudness you can change it on Spotify, for example. You can say what your background level of noise is. But equally, next week they might decide that their target streaming is a different number of lofts, and therefore if you spend all your time kind of carefully crafting, you know, 10 different versions, but it was basically it was a waste of time, and I don't think you get that much sonic benefit from it, really.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, and then if someone's listening on headphones, it's going to sound different than if you're blasting it out of really expensive speakers. So
yeah,
variables in the way people experience it anyway. But certainly, yeah, having the cut the lacquer is a totally different thing from shooting it out to, you know, people listening on, you know, Apple Music or whatever else they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I think like the bigger difference is in the mastering process.
So
the mastering process is to do with thinking about who's going to be listening and how and what they might want to hear and what makes it sound good and how to bring out the mixes as best as possible. That's all the key stuff. I fly like paper, get high like planes. If you catch me at the border, I got visas in my name. If you come around here, I'll make a more day.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. As the weather warms up, Revolution's new premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. When you started getting into music, did you sort of have thoughts of being a performer? I mean, you learned instruments and you were playing instruments. Like, what was your sort of, I hate the word journey, but what was your journey from getting into music to ending up doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. I started out playing instruments.
What was your first instrument?
What was my first instrument? I think my first instrument was the drums. And then I really wanted to learn the clarinet as well. I went to, so I grew up in London. I think the London Symphony Orchestra, they do like concerts for kids where they'll like solo all the instruments, you know, they'll like point out who's playing what and like what it sounds like. I actually really vividly remember going to, it was either the LSO, I think it was the LSO, going to a concert, like when I was like 9 or 10 and doing this and going away being like, I want to play the clarinet, which was wild. I don't really play the clarinet anymore, but it was nice. That was a nice thing to get into. So I played the drum kit and I played the clarinet and I played the saxophone. And my school was really good for music. My borough, I was at school in Camden in North London and it was really good for music. There's like a kind of borough music service that is doing all sorts of good work, and still are. I had lots of really great teachers, but I didn't really want to be like a soloist. That was never particularly my style. I also was never very diligent at practicing, so was never the best at anything, which obviously isn't a useful measure for anyone, turns out, but at the time felt like a reason not to get into it.
Doing kind of like jazz at the time? Because if you're doing saxophone or...
I was doing all, yeah. So I played like drum kit in like bands. We had like a couple little kind of indie bands at the time. New Rave was really big when I was a teenager. So we had a New Rave band. I was playing sax in big bands and like small kind of jazz bands. I was playing clarinet and orchestral percussion in orchestras. Yeah, I was kind of basically doing everything. So my musical tastes and my musical output has always been very broad. I just sort of like, I don't know. We listened to quite a lot of music. My parents, they're pretty into music, although they're kind of, they definitely have a period of time like that they're into. So that for them was like the 60s and 70s, early 80s maybe. So we listened to a lot of music in the kitchen and in the car. And so I kind of got interested in the background of music and like what was happening, like what was going on in order for us to be able to listening to it. Like I remember sort of like noticing that they're like the different parts in like recorded music. So like suddenly realizing that like the bass line was a thing, you know, and was a kind of a key component, as it were, like breaking down sound. I did music tech at school. Our school had a little recording studio attached to like a little tiny little cubby hole. It was great. And we just spent all our time in there when I was sort of 16, 17, 18, me and my friends. And then I went and did a sound recording, music and sound recording degree at Surrey University, called the Tom Meister course. Which is really good. I kind of, I've always been quite into maths and physics as well. Like I'm happy with the kind of technical, side of music as much as anything else. And so going and doing a course that was kind of equal parts, like maths and physics, music, and then kind of audio engineering, appealed and going somewhere that I wanted to go to university, and I wanted to go somewhere that had a good recording studio because I was enjoying spending so much time in the recording studio at school. And then it kind of all went from there, really.
Do you remember when, you know, when you first were in a recording studio, which sounds like it was in school, like what that moment was where you thought, oh, this is like where I really love to be. I really love this process, or, you know, like isolating this bass track really, you know, opened my eyes or something like that.
Ah, I don't know if I do have like a specific memory of the kind of technical recording process, but it was just like, it was so collaborative. It was so, you could record the little drum room next door, which was where me and my band had our kind of band rehearsals. And then you could record from the hall, which is on the other side. So like, you know, had to do some kind of like pop recording or something for like a piece of work at school. And I remember having like my friends who were all like studying really hard, and they all went off, or a lot of them went off into conservatoires. So they were all really good. They are really good now. They were really good then. They're like playing their kind of like their violas and their violins, and like recording onto a, it was an older Pioneers track that I did for that piece of coursework. Yeah, just really loving that kind of collaborative process, I guess.
Do you remember the first record you ever bought for yourself?
I think it was the soundtrack album to a film called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good one.
It's really good. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. I still listen to it. I really like that kind of close harmony sort of, don't know how to describe it, like, yeah, sound.
It's about as far from hip hop as you can get. But
Yeah. My musical tastes are pretty broad. Yeah. We listened to a lot of jazz when I was a teenager, because we had some really good jazz teachers, and we went to a lot of gigs. You could go see them play across London.
When you started doing stuff in the studio, did it make you come, when would you go home and listen to, you know, recordings and sort of think, oh, like, how was that recorded? Oh, this is a really interesting thing they did here. Like, were you like kind of analytical in that way, kind of breaking things down when you listen to music?
I think so. It's actually quite hard to remember when, you know, knowledge comes. Like, I go and talk to students, and I've been back to my school before and like spoken to the kids there.
Nice.
And I sort of forget that obviously they don't know stuff. Like, that's totally cool. They're like 16, 17. Why would they? And like, and that actually I have been learning a lot since I was 16 in the last whatever, 15, 16 years. I can't quite pinpoint when things were, but I do remember, yeah, like just playing around with like reverb and I don't know, sound generally.
And did you have a point where you consciously thought you'd like to pivot from live engineering into, you know, like the mastering side of it? Or was this something where they were just sort of opportunities and you realized you liked, you know, doing the mastering part of it?
Yeah, I think it's more opportunities based. So I did the degree that I did was mostly like studio recording and mixing. We didn't really do any mastering because it's sort of too project specific almost to teach to like a bunch of students. And, you know, there's too much to know within recording and mixing to even think about mastering, I think. But we did a placement year, like a year in industry as the third year. So it was a 4-year course. And the third year was you go find a job for a year. And one of the places I worked at, I went to a big studio complex that was in London called Tileyard Studios, and I was at a record label mastering studio called Gearbox Records. I don't know if you come across them.
I read about them, yeah.
They're all analog too.
Right?
They're all analog. It was this beautiful studio. It still is. They have all this really lovely equipment, this 1960s Scully lathe. And it was really fun working on the record label side of things. So kind of seeing the way like the releasing the music. We used to go do the independent label market every year. You know, we'd like travel around selling records and mastering just kind of appealed as the kind of the blend of the creative and the technical. And also because I've never not done vinyl as part of my mastering kind of career, because that was an all analog studio. And I wanted to carry on learning more. I perceived it as a, you know, useful skill, like an important thing to be able to do and to maintain and to learn from the guys, you know, well, they're all guys, but from the people that were there like originally. So then I went back there after university, carried on working there for a bit, and then a job came up at Air with an engineer called Ray Staff, who's like legendary, used to be at Trident, back in the day. And Yeah, and it just it seemed like a really great opportunity to keep learning about something that I'd already kind of started getting into. It just all went from there, really.
Did you have people you looked up to, and then also, people who mentored you? I mean, I'm imagining some of the people like Ray Stoff and Barry Grint probably helped you a fair amount,
Yeah, definitely.
but sort of going into it, are there sort of like the legends of the field? Like, we're like, oh, this is like, these are the ones who I aspire to reach that level.
I don't think I ever spent like too much time thinking in abstract terms. The thing with mastering is it is quite a small world. So like, yeah, Ray and Barry for sure. But like I can speak to Matt Colton. Like they've all been really welcoming. Miles at Abbey Road, Miles Showell, like really communicative and welcoming. I mean, I think, when I was at Gearbox, we talked a lot about Rudy Van Gelder, of course. So I
Right.
guess he is the only like absolute legend that I kind of would look up to in a more abstract sort of way, perhaps.
I picked up this early soul jazz record from Idris Muhammad on the Kudu label, and it just like, I think it's called Power of Soul, and it just jumped out of the speakers, and the bass was so present, and I was like, whoa. And I looked on the Dead Wax, and it says Van Gelder, and I'm like, yep, there it is.
Cool. Yes, I mean, yeah. There's definitely a legend right there. All those records. We had a big Blue Note collection at Gearbox, and that was a really interesting yeah, it was amazing to kind of get to know those records.
Is there any cultural difference or approach difference among, British engineers versus American engineers?
Almost undoubtedly yes, but I don't think I know what it would be. I think Ray would probably have quite a lengthy answer for you on that one. Yeah. I don't know enough American engineers. I've kind of visited Stirling before. Had a quick chat with Randy Merrill, but otherwise, yeah,
I
don't
talked to
know.
Greg Colby.
Cool. Did
So,
he
and
have
I,
an answer for whether there was a big difference between the
no,
UK
I didn't think of the question until just
and
now. So I need to
America?
rewind and think of that question. It hadn't really occurred to me, but I was just thinking about how, yeah, you got like Miles Showell and just all of you, and then here everyone's like there's like Bernie Grundman and Chris Bellman and the Ryan Smith and Kevin Gray and Bob Ludwig. So you have like these sort of different names over here than there. And I was wondering if there was kind of like a, it's like, oh, because I mean, certainly people for pressings, like everyone like, oh, you have to get the original UK pressing. It's much better than the American pressing from 1967 or whatever else.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that in the American sound or UK sound in terms of like production values, I think. Perhaps has always been a difference, whether it's a notable one that has always been the same difference. Again, I don't know, but
So do you ever get artists coming in when you're doing a new album and, they want to sort of hear the mixes and will they sit in there with you? Is there that kind of direct?
yeah, definitely. It's a balance actually, of both. It's really nice when people come in actually, because it can be a really sort of quick back and forth. You get a much better, context, particularly for mastering. It can very easily be a very short process right at the end of quite a long process. Someone might have been writing and then recording and then mixing for years, who knows, before they kind of get to me. And so getting the context for an album can be really nice. But then also sometimes there's something quite fun about it just being like a purely sonic process, and that it's like part of it is that I don't have the context. I don't know what happened, to X member of the band at whatever time,
Right.
while they were trying to write whatever song. Like that, none of that is relevant. All I have is what is in front of me and what has been made, and trying to make that come across as well as possible to the people who are going to be listening to it, who also don't have that context. So it's sort of interesting to take both approaches.
Yeah, I would assume a big part of your value would be that you're coming in with fresh ears and you don't have all that. You don't know that one day the song was recorded, everyone was mad at each other or something. You're just hearing what's on the tape.
Exactly. It definitely is. It's a really important, like the kind of gut response is a really important thing to be going with, and like maintaining that kind of freshness and the kind of fresh ears.
Have you had any artists who wanted you to do things that you just absolutely thought were wrong for the record?
Occasionally, occasionally, but at the end of the day, it's not my music. it's my professional output, but it's not my artistic output, as it were. So it's not really for me. If that's what they really, really want, then that's what they really, really want, I guess.
Have you ever had something you're supposed to master and you're just like, I just dislike this so much, I have to give it to someone else?
No, thankfully, I can very honestly say no to that. But what helps with whether I like it or not is whether I feel a connection to it or not. And I'm almost undoubtedly going to feel a bit more of a connection because someone has come to me because they want me to work on it with them and it's their music. So like, we're already set up quite well because like that's such an honor and that's such a nice thing to happen that that I'm unlikely to turn around and hate it. Thankfully, I don't actually know what will happen. I'm sure at some point someone's going to send me something that is like deeply offensive or I don't know. Like, I don't know what I'll do if I get halfway through listening to the lyrics and then suddenly realize what they're about, you know?
Yeah. Is there a different kind of pressure when you're pulled in to work on, you know, like David Bowie and it's a catalog that's so familiar to a lot of people and also beloved by people and you know, people know David Bowie. Do you approach that differently than when you have like some new band coming in?
I would try not to. You know that there are expectations and about that kind of people talking about the record or making assumptions about the intentions, like that has happened, you know, with the Bowie thing where people will be like, I can't believe they sat there and they actively decided to do this specific thing, you know, just to spite me or, you know, whatever. And obviously like we weren't there sitting there thinking about that, but in the moment that we were there, you know, that thing didn't come up and actually maybe it should have done or not or whatever. You're kind of aware that there's a bit more of a, like a weight of responsibility, but you've got to trust in the process. Like with the Bowie specifically, the kind of the producer of the whole catalogue of the whole output, Nigel Reeve was, you know, he was there and he had made these plans with Bowie. And then subsequently after Bowie's death, like he worked really closely with the estate. So like, you've got to trust that people are doing things to the best of their intention and to the best of their ability. I'm privileged to know that that was the case, you know, in that instance. So like, I know what the thinking was and I was in the room when it was discussed. So that's a sort of unique or privileged position, really.
Do you ever get goosebumpy when you're just listening to this, you know, just these Bowie tapes that are just like these, yeah, you know, from the source and you're like, wow, that's it. That's Bowie right there.
Yes. And like, there were some instances of that project where we had the multi-track needed to be transferred. So we had the full, you know, just like, so we did that. We did Let's Dance, I think, from the original half inch. And that was amazing. Cause that's where a record that I probably, that was of all of his records, that was the one I knew the best before working on that particular project. We had the kind of instrumentals for Life on Mars or something. Well, we had the multi-track so that we could get the instrumental and like, that's unreal to just be able to like pull up different faders and listen to these sounds that you know so well.
Wow.
It was incredible. Yeah.
Do you have like any sort of bucket list of, you know, artists you'd like to master or remaster?
No, maybe I should think about that. I feel like I've maybe not like, I just feel really lucky to be doing what I'm doing. And I don't really want to jinx it by like projecting too far forward about what I might or might not get sent, I guess.
So in last year, you won the Music Producers Guild Mastering Engineer of the Year Award.
Yeah.
So, well, congratulations on that. Like, how does that happen? And it also sounded like the process of that was really interesting. Where I read you talking about how you have to submit before and after versions for them to sort of show your work. And I'm wondering, like, so what was it you sent to them? And is it just like you send the raw tape and then you send the mastered?
Yeah. So you send the mix and the master.
Right.
I don't know how it came about. You nominate, you know, anyone can nominate anyone to go on the long list, and then the kind of the MPGs, any member of the MPGs, any full member can then vote to make the shortlist. And then for mastering on the shortlist, you then all the people on the shortlist, which was three people, submit before and afters, and there's a kind of judging panel of I don't know, about 20 people or something that then listen to the befores and afters and decide who they thought was best.
So what song or songs did you submit?
So for that one, it was a band called Witch Fever, whose debut album I mastered, and I think I cut the lacquers as well. They're like doom punk. They're really cool. Would highly recommend that record if you think you might like doom punk.
I don't know if I like doom punk. Yeah. I like some punk. I'm not as much of a doom guy, but I'm. But lately, it seems like the doom might be appropriate. So
yeah, right. There's just a lot of catharsis to be found in doom.
There you go.
They're really great.
I will check it out.
Yeah, would recommend. So I did one of their tracks. It's a band called Palace, who I work with, who are on Fiction Records. They're kind of a bit more indie rock. And then there was a, what did I do? Oh, I think it was I did a soundtrack album. Was it this I submitted? It was a soundtrack for a theatre show called Prima Facie. And the music was by Self-Esteem, but under her real name, Rebecca Taylor, I think it is. So it was quite like that soundtrack was really interesting, actually. It was just a cool kind of mix of sounds, and like some slightly more acoustic-y kind of stuff, but then some kind of just like found sounds, lots of sort of voices, lots of vocal kind of noises. So I think those were the three that I submitted. So it's just one track from each album.
Cool. Was the winner announced in like a ceremony, or did you just get an email like, hey, you won?
No. So it was like the Oscars ceremony. It was cool. You don't know. You're just sitting there and they have an envelope and then they announce it. So there's some quite funny footage that my friends took of just me looking completely bemused, but like obviously thrilled. I hadn't written a speech or anything because I really wasn't expecting to win. So to go up and do some thank yous.
Wow. So you did. You got up and said thanks and you took the statue and everything else.
Yeah.
Has that made a difference in, so that was last May. Has that made a difference in your career since then?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, like almost immediately. Just more booked up. I think it's more of a, like, it's obviously a very big external validation. So if someone hasn't heard of me, but someone says, oh, you know, I recommend Sicily, then they can look up that. And that's quite cool that I've won an award. That helps. Yeah, I think definitely been a lot busier, busier since then, which has been great.
It's interesting in general that like mastering engineers have become much more known. I mean, where you know, your name is on the front of all those VMP records I've gotten.
Yeah, I know.
And you know, you'll go to Record Store Day and it'll be like, you know, the Chris Bellman or the Kevin Gray or the, you know, like the Greg Colby, Bernie Grundman. I mean, like all these. You know, Ryan Smith, they're all like, you're all kind of brand names now. Like people sort of look for it. They're going to look for the Sicily cut.
Yeah. It's, that's kind of amazing to me. It's not why I got into it. It's been a sort of interesting development since I have. I've got friends who are producers or friends who are, mix engineers or whatever, or work in labels, and they say sometimes artists come and they're like, they don't mind who's going to mix it or produce it, but they know who's definitely going to be mastering it, which is completely wild, like, because we're only working on what's already been done. So
right. Well, and you went into like this, you know, obviously behind the scenes profession, and now it's not so behind the scenes anymore because people absolutely know who you are. You're a celebrity.
Yeah, it's weird. It's something I'm, you know, working on, trying to inhabit a bit better, you know. But it's hard because, I went into it to be behind the scenes, and it's not my music. Like, it's not my. I don't know how to like. You know, I'm contributing, but I would never like presume to say I'm dictating anything about the sound or like it's not my artistic. The amount that's changing in mastering compared to the amount, you know, is so small compared to the amount of change that happens from a song not existing to a song being mixed. Like, you know, It's a really strange category of us, but maybe we've become partly the kind of celebrity side of it. It's very odd.
There you go. What do you think is the most commonly misunderstood aspect of what you do?
Most commonly misunderstood. I think that there's very broadly two camps of people, and one camp thinks that mastering is this like process where loads changes, where you're going to affect the sound in a really huge way. And one camp thinks that mastering is just purely technical and you shouldn't affect the sound at all and nothing is going to change. And I don't know if they always realize that each other exist, because So people send stuff to me and they're, or I'll send something back and they'll be like, oh, it's not quite what we were thinking. We were expecting that you weren't going to do anything. And then some people be like, it's not quite what we were thinking. We're expecting you to do way more. And I have to like judge that within about a split second of having met them as to which camp they fall into and therefore what they're looking for.
Is there back and forth? Like, will you sort of, sometimes you'll be like, look, this is not my, this is not what I can do. I can't change the way the drums are recorded. But do you go back and forth on, you know, the lacquers or the mixes and the mixes, but the masters, and say, okay, you know, well, I can boost this if that's what you need.
Definitely. And, you know, I always say, you know, revisions are completely fine, because I'm only going off my gut impression and my, you know, and sometimes you might not quite grasp the whole of the artistic vision from your first listen, and you might have pushed it in one direction and they're thinking, well, actually, we would rather it was going to go in this other direction. And I think it's really important to be able to have that communication. It's another common misconception that like, that I won't change that. Or maybe some people don't, but like, I'm not going to email back and be like, no, what I think goes.
Don't you know who I am?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm the mastering engineer of the year.
Yeah, that's it. So I'm probably not going to do that.
What do you listen to at home and how do you listen to it?
It's a good question. I go in huge phases of whether I listen to stuff at home, and it's also very much to do with I don't know what the word is, like circumstance. At the moment, I do 12-hour shifts and my commute is an hour and a half. So by the time I get home, I'm normally pretty frazzled and I don't really want to listen to anything.
Right.
I listen to quite a lot of, I've been in a bit more of a kind of uplifting pop kind of phase at the moment. So, you know, Miley Cyrus's new record, or that amazing Kylie track with Amsterdam, it's been great. I have a lot of, as I said, I have a lot of jazz records. I do listen to those, or I listened to them when I was growing up. I went through a big kind of bit more of a punky rock kind of phase. The Beths, I got really into at one point.
Oh, I like the Beths. So like New Zealand.
Yeah, they're really, really cool. Yeah. So it kind of varies and goes up and down, because if I'm feeling just like tired and a bit overwrought with listening anyway, then listening for pleasure becomes a bit difficult. And what do I listen on? We have a nice sort of Franken system between me and my housemates at the moment. So I have a Pioneer amp and a Rager turntable, and my housemate has some Rogers speakers, so we kind of cobbled them all together into a nice system in the living room. And then I've also got a Sonos speaker that we have in the kitchen, that's just good for, you know, your kitchen raves.
It's your basic nice home system, not your show off audiophile, you know, God, tens of thousands of pounds worth of equipment sort of thing.
Unfortunately, I don't have tens of thousands of pounds to spare, so not yet. People ask me that and they say, how many records do I have? And my honest answer to that is that I've moved house. I've not lived in one place for more than 18 months since I moved out when I was 18. And so I can't, like, I have records, but I don't have that many records because I have to carry them everywhere all the time, every time I move, which is my choice. Like, I'm not claiming any hardship, it's quite hard to kind of build up too much stuff if you move house every 18 months.
And you haven't had the audio equipment companies offering you equipment in exchange for your endorsement or something?
I mean, a little bit. Not quite yet, but some are coming through. The Sonos, I mean, I do actually like the Sonos speakers, that helps. But that was nice. My wife's Sonos, so he sends me things to listen to and to give my opinion on, which is really cool.
Well, and again, if it, you know, if you're working 12 hours a day listening to the music, it's, you know, it's maybe not like, oh, I got to come home and crank something up on my $10,000 system or something like that.
Exactly. And also, like, you know, I think there's such a big, I like it when music sounds good. I am looking forward to having a place that I live and investing some money in some nice speakers and things like that. But, like, you know, music is for enjoyment, and I get just as much enjoyment out of someone putting a track that they really like on their laptop and we will dance around it, like around the kitchen to it. Like, that's really fun, and that's what music is for. And I think getting too bogged down into the detail of what you're listening on and how can, there's a time and a place for it as a kind of appreciation thing, but like, it's not exclusively what music is about.
Right. Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks so much. Cool. Anything that I, what do I have to look forward to you mastering next that I should be listening for or looking for?
There's an incredible album by an artist called Girly, which I really, really like. And I think is coming out this month or maybe next. It's called Matriarchy, and it's just really fun. I think it's maybe what caused this, like, this uplifting pop thing that I'm going to do. It's really part and parcel, and it's been really good. I cut the lacquers for the new Judas Priest record. I don't know if that's come out. I think it's been announced at least.
Wow.
So that's cool. Again, that's been fun getting into Judas Priest a bit and catching up on lots of things that I wasn't there for in the 80s.
Wonderful talking with you. Thank you.
Really
for,
nice chat.
Thank you for doing this.
Nice see to you meet you.
Bye. That's all for episode 127 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Cicely Ballston for sharing her adventures in the studio and her rise to becoming the Music Producers Guild's Mastering Engineer of the Year. If you'd like to learn more about her work and maybe hire her for your next project, go to airstudios.com/Cicely-Ballston. You also can find her on Instagram at Cicely Ballston, one word. If you'd like to check out the Vinyl Me Please albums she has mastered, go to vinylmeplease.com. And if you'd like a referral for club membership, let me know. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who never sweats the technique. Now you can become a Caropop friend for a mere $24. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated and helps keep us going. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CarolPopCast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.